Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Shawn Shadow was 25 when she died on May 22nd of this year. She suffered from severe depression and anxiety. Shawn had sought help seeking treatment for her illness from doctors and therapists. None of it seemed to ease the pain. She turned to a website that provided a recipe for her suicide and didn't attempt, that website did not attempt to stop Shawn from taking her life. Now a law is being proposed that would make it a crime to assist or encourage another person to end their life by suicide. Joining us on this portion of today's program is Republican State Representative Dawn Kiefer of York County. Representative Kiefer, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
Before we get started in our conversation, Jackie Bieber, who is Shawn Shadow's mother, appeared on our program with Shawn's stepfather last June, just a month after Shawn had taken her life. I want to go back to part of that conversation with Jackie Bieber.
Not suicide. She discussed the anxiety, how she felt and how she didn't like being around people. She was going to doctors and getting different medications to try to, you know, to cure that. As I know from experience, anxiety leads to depression, which is where she went with her anxiety because it was so bad. But she was certainly working on it.
But she was in treatment, though.
Yeah, she was in treatment. She said she did not want to die.
She didn't want to be this way. She didn't want to die.
She actually said that.
She has said that, yes. Mm.
Shawn died in May.
May 22nd.
You looked at her phone afterwards. What did you find?
We had found on the browser history that she was on a website.
Which we won't name, by the way.
Yes, and we found some messages from her that said, you know, what she took. She also had mentioned, because I was home working that day, and I was right down the hall. She said that my mom is down the hall. I feel bad because my mom is down the hall from me. And they just said, good luck. For some reason, I'm not 100% this will work because your mother is down the hall. If she hears noises coming from your room, she will come in and call an ambulance if you're in a bad way. I'm not trying to stop you. I'm just saying.
They actually said, we're not trying to stop you.
Yes. And then when she finally took the last part of what she needed to take to end it, she said, I just took it. I'm terrified. And everyone just gave her thumbs up and said, hope it goes smoothly. Good luck to you.
Yeah, there wasn't a single comment that maybe you should go talk to your mom since you're close to her, or maybe you should reconsider, or are you sure this is what you want to do?
Not one person on that other end. I mean, she was actually interacting with multiple people.
Yes.
And not one person said, have you thought this through?
No.
Maybe you should go get some help.
Yeah, not one.
Not one.
That was Jackie Bieber, along with her husband and Shawn's stepfather as well, on our program last June. Representative Kiefer, first of all, that's heartbreaking to hear.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is just a parent's worst nightmare.
Right. And could you imagine an arm's length away?
Right.
And you would have run in there to do anything you could, but you didn't know. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. Well, so let's start with your legislation. What would it do?
Okay, so it's already a crime in Pennsylvania for aiding or assisting in suicide, and currently it's a second-degree felony or a second-degree misdemeanor. And the second-degree felony would carry 5 to 10 years, $25,000 fine, and the second-degree misdemeanor would be up to 2 years in jail, $5,000 fine. And my legislation was essentially, it's a sentencing enhancement. So it would allow the judge to weight this crime heavier in a different manner so he could give additional years or additional, we can't break it out to an exact formula, but he would have the ability to give additional penalties for this crime. Mm-hmm. And it's specifically for 18 years and younger and intellectually disabled.
All right. So why 18 and younger and intellectually disabled?
So we were walking a fine line with this when I met with the Biebers and I first heard of this. I came out, you know, guns blazing. I wanted to do something. I couldn't believe such a website even existed in the first place. And as I sat down with our legislative assistants and everybody helping me to craft this, they said, you know, just going for a broad sweep where it wasn't specifically 18 or intellectually disabled, it would never stand muster in a court because of freedom of speech. So with the assumption that 18 and years and younger and intellectually disabled do not have the mental capacity to make these kind of decisions for themselves. So we could say that these individuals are preying on our children and our most vulnerable populations. Mm-hmm.
By the way, if you have a question or comment and would like to weigh in on today's conversation, give us a call at 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, on the surface, there are many people that would think that this would be a simple piece of legislation, a simple law to craft, because you look at such a website and most people would look at it and say, that's horrible. You know, that there is a website that not only encourages but provides the kind of information on how to successfully take one's own life, that it's just a horrible thing that such a thing exists. But this is not an easy law to craft because there are so many what-ifs and constitutional issues, quite frankly, surrounding it. And you mentioned to me that the Judiciary Committee said to you that, okay, we support what you're doing here, but there are some problems.
It's a slippery slope. So you could apply this to something else. Did somebody make an ingest statement on the internet, and now will they be held liable? It's very slippery. And so how do you grab those pieces that you can? So we looked at the victims, and we took a victim standpoint currently. So starting with 18 and younger and are intellectually disabled. But, you know, as we keep evolving and we really start to address mental health, I think that this is another vulnerable population. I don't believe that they are clearly they have some impairment, right, with depression. And so I think, I mean, this website, this is a completely predatory website that we have. And how do we protect this class of individuals that are out there that are suffering from anxiety and depression and, you know, mental health ailments? Now they're a new set of victims for this. This group, I just never, as a parent of three, I never knew it even existed. Never knew it existed. And there's no, you know, anybody can get on the website. You can say you're 18. You don't have to have any guidelines there. So how do you protect people from this kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the questions that I have to say that one of the first questions I had is, let's face it, the internet is worldwide. There's a reason it's called the World Wide Web.
Right.
And from what I understand, this website in particular is not based in Pennsylvania. So first of all, isn't what you're trying to do, shouldn't it be under federal guidelines? How do you restrict or how do you prosecute someone who is out of state if this crime is committed toward a Pennsylvanian?
So because the victim is in Pennsylvania, our district attorneys and can go after those if they're convicted of this, regardless of what state they're in. So we do have that latitude. But then as far as, you know, how do you start addressing these organizations that are existing throughout the state or country and the world, quite frankly, how do you go after them? You're right. That on that level, we are at the federal level, and we would be dealing with we'd have to work with Congress and our United States senators to start addressing that. But it's you're dealing with freedom of speech, constitutional issues, and it's a fine line that you're walking.
Do you know of any thing on the federal level that this is on their radar?
No, I have not seen. From the research that I had, this is not on their radar.
Mm-hmm. No. So let's start here at the state level. Let's talk about some of those constitutional issues. Freedom of speech, and you know, many people have they use white supremacist group or racist groups, for example, that hate groups that espouse hate, but their speech is protected by the Constitution, the First Amendment of the Constitution, because they do have freedom of speech. I'm sure that would be the first defense that a website, if this was taken into a court of law, the first defense would be, we have a constitutional guarantee of freedom of speech. Doesn't matter that you disagree with it, but that we can say whatever we want to.
And that's true. They do. You know, to say something hateful is not a crime. But this goes further than saying something hateful. This is assisting someone to take their own life. And even if you say, okay, the encouraging part, you can say what you want, but now they're assisting them. So there was the case in Massachusetts where the young girl helped her boyfriend.
Yes.
I mean, and it was, they had the stream of texts and all the correspondence there where she kept saying, and like she was not satisfied until she knew he took his life. In fact, he even got out of the truck and try, was going to get out, and she said, you get back in that truck. And you know, until it was done, she was not finished. And so she was convicted. And I think that gives us precedence. Now, some attorneys have said to me they don't think that, you know, that would stand muster in Pennsylvania. I don't know. But I as a parent and, you know, as a family member with many family members suffering from depression, I want to try. I want to try. Let's push this to the full extent. And so I'm taking a step back from the perpetrators and looking at the victims. And so if at some point are we going to get to the conversation where, you know, if you're suffering from, my daughter has severe anxiety issues that we've been struggling with. And that can lead to depression, or you have other, a myriad of mental health illnesses. Are they capable? Is this a vulnerable population? I really think it is. And so, you know, this is the angle I'm looking at. Like, let's look at the victims and, you know, maybe they need a different type of protection. And so if these predators come after this class of individuals that, you know, are already vulnerable, you know, let's attack it from that side. I don't know. Let's work within the law and let's get creative.
The woman you mentioned in Massachusetts was in the news last week. I think she was sentenced to 2 years in prison, and she's asked for early release. I think she served 9 months of that prison term. But, yeah, so, you know, she asked for it. That doesn't mean that she's going to get it, but she did go to jail. A lot more to talk about, Representative Kiefer. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. You can see some of the programs we're working on for the future, including ending sentences of life without parole, the art of storytelling, and changing Pennsylvania science curriculum in schools. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. On today's program, our guest during this portion of the program is State Representative Dawn Kiefer of York County. She's introduced legislation that would strengthen the penalties for those who assist in suicides. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, let's talk about some of the other parts of the bill. The word encourage suicide. How do you enforce that? There probably is not a legal definition for the word encourage.
Right. There probably is a technical definition for it, but that's going to be the judge's discretion. It's going to be giving the judge discretion. So I really can't get into their mind, but there's a way that they weight, for example, DUIs and your level of responsibility in that. And it would be similar with that. So, I can't get into the exact formula. I sat down with my York County DA's office, and we really picked through this on what we could and couldn't do, and how it would, how the judge would interpret this, or how he would apply this. And you know, they too kept saying, well, it's not exact science, but you know, there's different things that you can use to weight the offense that has happened. In the Beavers case, they had received on her phone follow-up messages from this group asking, did Sean pass? Was it peaceful after her death? Could you imagine getting those messages from this group? So they came into my office with, you know, a good 4 or 5 inches worth of paper to show me, you know, the different text threads that were there and the communication back and forth, and that's all information that they could provide to the DA's office to help with the prosecution.
The Beavers also received messages after Sean passed, criticizing them, downright attacking them for speaking out against their website. And I mean, this was particularly cruel. I even received one, you know, started off by saying, "You're the worst broadcaster I ever heard," and then went into, "These people have a right to take their own life. You're taking away their freedom of choice with, you know, criticizing them, legislation like that." Now, have you received anything like that?
I received,
because I think you will.
Right. One random email and that I couldn't link back to that group per se, and it didn't have a name on it, similar type thing, criticizing me and, you know, freedom of choice, and this is free speech. And so then I go back to, okay, they have the right to take their own life, but... that's why, again, I focused on the 18 and younger and the intellectually disabled. Their brain's not even fully developed, or they don't have the capacity to make that kind of a decision. And I wanted to try to extend that out a little bit further. If we're talking about people that are suffering from depression and anxiety and a whole battery of mental illness, do they have the capacity to make that decision? And take Sean's case, where she said to her parents, "I don't want to die. I feel this way. It's awful. She can't get outside of this bubble," but she did not want to die. And she went to that website and said, "I'm scared. I don't know what to do." And they said, you know, there's a phrase, they say, "Jump the bus and you can do it." They encouraged her to do it. I just find it, it's just, in today's society, it's just one new level of how we're, you know, the depravity that we go into with our society, that, you know, you think how do you fall from the floor? But we seem to do it.
Tim called. He said, "Those websites have no idea who they are, quote, helping to die by suicide. And the people seeking the help of the sites have no idea who is on the other end either. I have a problem punishing people who think they are offering a service to someone seeking their help and are duped into believing they are helping an adult."
Right. And that was part of it. You always had that. We didn't know. And we had a disclaimer on there. That's all, you know, that's all well and good. And it's all things that we'll have to figure out how to navigate on the legal side of things. I understand what they're saying. People will change their tune if they find out, you know, "It was my father on there. That was my father on there. You helped my father on a step by step," instead of, you know, helping him to seek help or to go elsewhere and get help. And it's not the, you know, not the end of the world, that there's always hope. They're just preying on them. And I'm not sure how we get to it, how we get to this group, but I'm going to start taking every shot we can.
We have a call from Anya in Lancaster. Anya, you're on the air.
Hi there. I've been listening to your program, and I listened to the program that you guys did back last June. I was curious about, what do we do about adults who, you know, have been suffering from mental health problems for a really long time? They're having suicidal ideations all the time, and that's really what they truly want as an adult. I'm speaking from experience. My mom has been suffering from mental health problems for over 50 years. And it's something that we grapple with as a family, is do we let her give up? Is that okay to do from a social standpoint? Are we, as a society, okay with allowing people to take their own lives?
Anya, because go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I think that, you know, these types of websites, of course, with young people and people who have developmental problems, that's not something that's healthy. But how long do we let someone suffer with depression or bipolar disorder or something like that without letting them make the choice on their own?
Anya, thank you very much for your call. And Anya brings up a point, and I think about Dr. Jack Kevorkian, that, as you mentioned very earlier in the program, there already are laws here in Pennsylvania for assisting someone in suicide. But what Anya is talking about is someone who, now, she said that her mother, who has suffered from mental illness for a long time, but there are other people who maybe have Alzheimer's, maybe have a painful cancer, something like that. What about that? I mean, would this, now granted, you're talking about 18 and under and intellectually disabled at this point right now, but what about that? I mean, I don't want to get into the whole sidetrack our conversation, your legislation, but this kind of does what Anya brings up, goes back to that discussion.
Right, but do we give up on drug addicts? Do we give up on them? Do we give up on, you know, somebody suffering? We're fighting to the end. And so, and it goes back to mental health as a disease. And, you know, we have some family members that really struggle with that in my family. And when they're in a good place and when they're able to, you know, when they've, they never truly conquer it, but when, you know, everything is stabilized, they would never want to die. So I don't think that's our, I don't think we have that power. That should not be us to help them. I mean, our goal should be to heal them, to provide services. And that's one of the things you talked about. What about somebody struggling with cancer? They're in so much pain. And we had a family member that was in a lot of pain. And that thoughts went through his head all the time. We do postpartum depression counseling with women after they have babies, but we don't do any kind of regular treatment, mental health treatment that goes along with, you know, oncology treatments. We have to start thinking. Mental health, currently we have it in two different paradigms in Pennsylvania. It's separate from the rest of your health. It needs to be together so it can be looked at comprehensively, and that is your true well-being, and so that we can address mental health as, hey, we're not, oh, yeah, that's right. Have you been in for a well checkup, or, you know, how are you doing that way? So we have to get at it. I don't say we give up on people. We don't give up on people.
Mm. You know, I just as I'm sitting here listening to you talk about this, it seems like your legislation that maybe what needs to happen is more of an emphasis on mental health, especially. I mean, we hear it in relationship to mass shootings. You know, we do hear it with suicides, but that we have a real issue in this country with, first of all, access to mental health treatment, the money that is needed for it. There are a lot of issues.
Well, right now, and somebody made a comment, something else with this, that said, you know, it's not funded. You haven't given enough money to it. But quite frankly, mental health in Pennsylvania, even if we put more money into it, we don't have providers. We don't have enough providers. So we need to look at credentialing, and we need to look at licensing, and, you know, where are we creating hurdles that don't need to be, that we can start allowing people to practice to the full scope of their license, which we don't do in Pennsylvania. There's a whole, we need to look at this comprehensively, but mental health is not gotten its attention given the numbers that we have in Pennsylvania with suicides, and you can link almost all of them back to mental health.
Now, I don't want to change the direction of our conversation, right? Because Sean Shadow was being treated for anxiety and depression, but yet still made the decision to take her own life. So even with additional resources, whether it be money, whether it be providers to help those who are suffering from mental illness or a mental issue, that doesn't guarantee that someone won't take their life.
It does not. And there's always a time period. So for the counseling to work, for if they're going to be, if it's some kind of pharmaceutical treatment that they're giving, there's a time frame for that to work. And then also you deal with bipolar and it's been working. And then all of a sudden they have some kind of a metabolic change and those medicines aren't working any longer. So you have the ebb and flow of depression too, where sometimes it's working and sometimes it's not. So you have those gaps there, and there's that whole just transitioning to finding something that's going to work, because every person's different and what's going to work for them to treat it. So it's not something easily addressed.
We have an email that says that the caller believes this is another well-meaning piece of legislation that is never going to get passed. This is constraint on free speech. Isn't this an attempt to bring attention to an unfortunate situation that has no real chance of passing?
I disagree that this is, again, because we're looking at a vulnerable population that does not have the ability to make these decisions for themselves. I disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. So you think it does have a chance?
Absolutely.
Do you have co-sponsors?
I do. I think there's like 20 or 30 co-sponsors that are on this. So I don't see this having any issue at all getting out of the House. And then, you know, I'll go partner up in the Senate and we'll get something through.
Bipartisan?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I doubt one party would.
This is not, mental health is not a partisan issue. Right?
No, it is not a partisan issue, and neither is suicide. So
right.
Do we have a call? Let's go to Sue in Harrisburg. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that a relative of mine has suffered from bipolar disorder for decades and with suicidal ideation. Excuse me. And she started to take a very low dose of ketamine about 6 months or so ago. And she takes it sublingually and sort of when needed. And it has eliminated her suicidal ideation. And what she said to me is, I didn't know a person could go through a day without thinking about killing themselves. So I think there are interventions that we need to be looking at a little bit more aggressively.
So thank you for telling your family story. Thank you very much. Now, just want to point out that that medication may work for some people, may not work for everyone, but the point being,
there's hope.
There is hope that there is treatment available. Sometimes it's difficult to find that right medication, the right treatment to keep someone, to improve their mental health, but it can be done.
There is hope, and there is all there, you know, and you're exactly right. What works for one will not work with the other. We are all engineered and wired differently. But again, I go back to, so are we going to give up? You know, why do you not just let them kill themselves? Because if they were well, they wouldn't want to do that. They wouldn't want to do that. And so I think we are, you know, whether we are our brother's keeper, we need to make sure that everything is out there and that they have access to what they need to get better. I don't know how else. And it's how we look at mental health, too, because, you know, my husband and I look at it quite differently, you know, and he'll say, you know, just snap out of it. Well, that sounds easy to do. If you're not, it is a mental, it's something that's got a hold of your brain, and it is sometimes a chemical imbalance, and there's a whole multitude of things that go with that. I just refuse to give up on people.
Mm-hmm. So we only have a few minutes left, Representative Kiefer. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. But so what do you want this to do? What, now, as you said, it's limited to 18 and under and those who are intellectually disabled, and it strengthens the penalties. But what do you want this legislation to do?
So I want this to maybe deter any other online chat forums of this nature. It has already deterred some of the activity of this current online chat forum, which I'm not going to mention any of those. And so I want people to think twice, bring attention to suicide, and that this is out there. People were unaware. Parents were unaware. I mean, I was unaware until it was brought to my attention. So I think we need to, you know, continue to bring attention to mental health and, you know, what that looks like. Awareness on the internet, you know, everything is out there. As a parent, we're so busy micromanaging everything else, and we don't pay attention to what they're doing on their phone or their laptop. So
that brings up another point. I mean, would you also encourage parents? I mean, you're not a counselor or a therapist or anything like that, but as a parent, and knowing what you do about these kind of websites, and that there are people who are vulnerable who may be checking them out, would you encourage parents to look at their children's online activity?
I think you have to. And I know parents will say, oh, I'm not a creeper or I don't want to do that. But they absolutely have to. And think of your child as a teenager and just how hormonally imbalanced they are in your home, interacting with you. Now you're going to put somebody susceptible like that to predators like that that are on the internet. And there's all kinds of depravity on the internet. And so as a parent, I think it's your responsibility. You have to. You have to take a look at what they're looking at.
So where is the legislation now?
So the legislation is in our Judiciary Committee. So once they have, they're just getting back in. We just came back last week. I'm hoping to get it out by the end of the fall.
Getting it out of
the committee and up for a vote.
Do you think it will be up for a vote this fall?
I'm not sure. We haven't got the whole agenda of what our itinerary looks like for this fall, but I'm hopeful that we will.
Mm-hmm. Republican State Representative Dawn Kiefer of York County, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to talk about a proposal that would end the sentence of life without parole in Pennsylvania, and also making sure juvenile offenders have representation. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. You can find out what's coming up on programs in the future here on Smart Talk by going to our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. You can also leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Pennsylvania has one of the fastest growing older populations in the country. As we age, our health may deteriorate as well. It may reach a point where we will need the aid of healthcare professionals on a regular basis. That could mean moving to an assisted living or nursing home. Now, most people would rather stay in their own homes if they can. The state is offering a program that could do just that while coordinating health care overall. It's called Community Health Choices. Joining us on today's program is Kevin Hancock, Deputy Secretary for Long-Term Living with the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services. Deputy Secretary Hancock, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Also joining us is Laval Miller-Wilson, who is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Health Law Project. Mr. Miller-Wilson, thank you for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Deputy Secretary Hancock, let me start with you. What is Community Health Choices?
Please call me Kevin.
All right, I will.
Community Health Choices is what's called a managed long-term services and supports program. So what it means is we are moving the Medicaid long-term care system from fee-for-service to managed care configuration. And that means that managed care organizations, insurance companies, will be managing the long-term care services. And long-term care services in this context mean nursing facility services, or home and community-based services for people who are 21 years of age and over and who are either dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid or in need of long-term services and supports, which means that they have some sort of a physical disability that requires some help for activities of daily living.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is something that we've heard about for the last few years, maybe the last decade or so,
sure,
that we, meaning the United States, that we will move to this type model where it will not be a fee-for-service pay every time you go to the doctor or that you consult a doctor, but that there will be, you know, managed care overall. Describe how that happens.
So Pennsylvania is actually a late adopter to this type of model. There are 25 states with some sort of managed care configuration for their long-term care system. We are going in this direction for a lot of different reasons. The most important reason at this point is that with the significant growth of the long-term care population and with the significant growth in the cost for the long-term care population, managed care has shown to just do a better job in the oversight, quality assurance, and fiscal management of these types of services.
Provide a description of what that's like.
So, the way the program is going to work is that we have three managed care organizations, unlike today, at least in this region, where the Department of Human Services has a direct relationship to long-term care providers like nursing facilities and home care agencies, those providers will contract with the managed care organizations, and the managed care organizations are going to be responsible for paying the providers for the services that they're delivering in long-term care. The department will pay the three managed care organizations, which are AmeriHealth Caritas, UPMC Community Health Choices, and Pennsylvania Health and Wellness, a per member per month fee, and the managed care organizations will be responsible for and at risk for providing all of the care from that per member per month dollar amount.
All right. Yeah, when you say all of the care, that's what I'm getting at, though. For someone who's hearing this and saying, well, what does that include? What is all of the care?
So in our program, it includes their physical health services. So most of the people who are in this program, in fact, 93% of the people who are in this program are in Medicare. So Medicare is going to pay for their hospitals and doctors and their in many cases their pharmacy services. And Medicare is the secondary payer. Community Health Choices will be the secondary payer for most people for physical health services. But Community Health Choices will be the primary payer for the long-term care services. like nursing facility services, like personal assistance services, where you have a direct care worker coming into somebody's home and helping them with bathing, with dressing, with cooking, and with all the activities of daily living that people may need support for. It also includes adult daycare, in some cases home modifications. A new service that we're offering with this program is pest eradication. So we're trying to emphasize people to be able to receive their services in the community, and we want people to be able to receive those services safely in the community. And we are doing all we can, including offering services like pest eradication and home modifications, to make sure that the home is safe for people to stay there, even if they have long-term care needs.
Is it as simple as saying that what you're doing is trying to find a way for people to stay in their own homes rather than go to an assisted living or to a nursing facility?
I wish it was as simple to say.
I think I knew the answer to that. Yeah. But
So we do want people to be able to stay in their home. People want to be able to receive their long-term care in the community. They want to be able to age in place, and we're designing this program to be able to support that. But we also are recognizing that nursing facilities will always be part of the long-term care continuum. And it's changing because most people in nursing facilities have what we call higher acuity, or they're sicker. So nursing facilities are still very much part of long-term care services. But what's changing is that they're supporting sicker, more complex populations. So it's both, actually. Long-term care in the community and long-term care in nursing facilities, both will be a part of community health choices.
As I said in the introduction, that most people, if given a choice, would probably prefer to stay in their own home.
That's correct.
But there is another reason as well. It is probably much less expensive for someone to stay in their own home than to go into an assisted living or a nursing care.
So on the whole, that's true. It is less expensive to be able to support people in the community in aggregate. But we do have a lot of people who are receiving long-term care in the community where it's actually much more expensive than it would be in a nursing facility. But from our perspective, that's not our primary concern. We want to be able to build a program that reflects participant preferences and their preferences to receive long-term care in the community.
Laval Miller-Wilson, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Health Law Project. The Pennsylvania Health Law Project, what does that have to do with community health choices?
Well, people have legal rights when they're in publicly funded healthcare systems. And if there is care that is denied, especially by new players like managed care plans, those plans have a responsibility to help coordinate services, put networks together. And if there's denials of any of the services that Kevin described, the managed care plans have to send a written denial notice. We as lawyers help folks navigate that process. We either help them with the service denial when a managed care plan reduces personal assistance services, denies a home modification, denies pest eradication. We don't see too much where a managed care plan says you can't go into this nursing home, although we may see it down the line. So what we do is we use the law to help challenge managed care plans and try and make sure that the services are person-centered.
You do this all over the country, correct?
No, we only do this in Pennsylvania.
You only do this
in Pennsylvania? Pennsylvania Health Law Project.
Well, right. Yeah, I knew that. But for some reason, I was thinking that there are other organizations like yours across the country and probably other states.
There are, although we have developed, and Pennsylvania is fortunate that it has a very strong system of a strong state monitoring system. And it has a strong state advocacy system. And we're a part of that state advocacy system. The right to legal assistance isn't guaranteed, but we do our best with a combination of funding to make sure that we're there for folks when they have difficulty navigating the health insurance landscape. For what I said before, when you're already eligible for Medicaid, but frankly, Scott, sometimes it's difficult even to get into Medicaid. And we also provide legal help to make sure that folks understand and if necessarily use the law to make sure that they get into the Medicaid program.
Why would it be difficult? Because it would seem that a lot of Medicaid would be based on income, that it would be cut and dry what eligibility is.
It's not so it's gotten easier, but Medicaid's a pretty complicated program. Just as a reminder for listeners, Medicaid's a federal and state program, a health insurance program. It's funded both by the federal government and by the state. And we spend a lot of money as a federal and state program. I think that to the tune of $27 billion, approximately, on the Medicaid program. The Medicaid program, though, is operated by Pennsylvania. It makes decisions about who's eligible, what the income guidelines are, and in the long-term care context, what the clinical guidelines are. Just because you make low income doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be eligible for long-term care. You also have to be found by the state to be clinically eligible. So on both sides, we have issues. Sometimes people are $3 above the income guideline, and we help them understand and figure out how to spend into the state's requirements. But also, some folks need to be found clinically eligible for the long-term care program and are denied. They think they do need to be enrolled in the program and the services that Kevin described, and there's a denial. So we represent them in those contexts, too.
Kevin, let's talk about eligibility. Who is eligible for this program?
So the program, as I said, covers individuals who are 21 years of age or over,
right.
And everybody who's dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, except for people who may have an intellectual disability and they're receiving services in another program. All of those dual eligibles will be brought in the program. And then also anybody who is 21 years of age or older and has some sort of a physical disability, and that's whether they are in a nursing home or if they're receiving long-term care in the community. They've already been found eligible for the Medicaid program in the process that Laval had described, may already be receiving services in the fee-for-service system. All of those people will be eligible for the program.
From what I understand, it's like 420,000 Pennsylvanians could be eligible.
It's actually 450,000.
Oh, it's up to 450.
It's growing like crazy.
Okay. I should have been a little more clear. Clinically eligible, as Laval had described, what eligibility requirements are there to be clinically eligible?
So the clinical eligibility standard for these programs, for somebody who needs long-term care, is nursing facility clinically eligible. So people go through a test or an assessment that determines if they have some sort of limitations in their activities of daily living. They may have mobility limitations. They may not be able to dress themselves. They may have problems in managing their medication, et cetera, et cetera. All those are sort of part of an assessment process. And at the end of the assessment, it's determined that they may have three or more of these limitations, it's likely the case that they'll be clinically eligible for the program.
Mm-hmm.
And just to say more about just the kinds of limitations, we call them activities of daily living.
Mm-hmm.
So
limitations
with bathing, limitations with food preparation, limitations even if the food is prepared, limitations with eating,
right.
Toileting. These are all situations that occur as we all age. We need more help. And it's a very vulnerable population because it is a low-income population. And that population doesn't often have family, caregivers. A number of folks are on their own. That's why this program of Medicaid is such a tremendous program, Scott, that Medicaid, just to remind listeners, is really the only program that provides this kind of care, chronic long-term care. Medicare doesn't pay for long-term care. Medicare doesn't pay for long-term nursing home. If you have Medicare and you need a nursing home, Medicare will pay generally up to about 100 days. After that, Medicare doesn't pay that bill. And if you're in the Medicaid program, then Medicaid doesn't pick it up. But it doesn't pick it up necessarily easily. You have to be eligible, financially eligible for it, and you have to be clinically eligible for it. If you hit both those, then you go into the program that we're describing, Community Health Choices.
I think that there are a lot of people whose eyes would be opened when they do. There may be a parent or a family member, a friend that they're helping to get into long-term nursing care, that they would be surprised at how difficult it is, and the payment system. As you mentioned, Medicare from the federal government only pays up to 100 days. And I don't know what the percentage of people who are living in nursing homes is, but my guess is it would be pretty high of Medicaid picks up a portion of that. The rest comes from Social Security, pensions, any kind of assets that you have. Many people don't realize that.
Yeah, most people... So a lot of people spend down to Medicaid eligibility. So they're paying for nursing facility care or even their own home care out of savings or some other resources they have. And then eventually, in nursing facilities specifically, they'll spend down to Medicaid financial eligibility. They're already clinically eligible because they're already in a nursing facility, but the spend down to Medicaid eligibility happens pretty frequently. So,
do you know what the percentage is of people who are living in nursing homes that that Medicaid pays a portion of that?
It varies by nursing home. So some nursing facilities have 100% Medicaid eligibility, and some other nursing facilities may have, we call it a payer mix, and the payer mix may be less than 30% Medicaid. It really depends on the nursing facility across mm-hmm. the state.
But, you know, Laval, something you said about being eligible for long-term nursing care, why wouldn't someone be eligible?
Well, they wouldn't be eligible for it. Again, there's the clinical side and the financial
side.
Right,
right.
They might not be eligible for it on the clinical side because an evaluator coming to someone's home says, I actually think you can do some of the activities of daily living. So we're going to find you ineligible on the clinical side. Financially, you're eligible, but on the clinical side, the state's made a determination, no. And that's where we at times step in and say, we do think that this applicant for Medicaid-funded long-term care is clinically eligible.
We have a caller, Nancy, who asks, says the person who is doing the analysis is often the final decision maker about the services the individual is qualified for. Should one person of unknown qualification be the sole decision maker in this important issue?
So as Laval pointed out, there are two components to financial eligibility or to long-term care eligibility, financial and clinical. So the people who do the clinical assessments are usually affiliated with the area agencies on aging, and they're subject matter experts when it comes to the long-term care system. In many cases, some of these assessors have been doing this type of an assessment or variations of this type of assessment for decades. So we consider their level of expertise and the contribution they're providing to the assessment process to be pretty indisputable. I mean, I think that they're trained well, and they have a lot of experience when it comes to doing these clinical assessments. The financial eligibility part is managed by our county assistance offices. And the department makes the final determination for eligibility. And once again, you have some pretty significant subject matter experts when it comes to long-term care financial eligibility in the county assistance offices that are making those decisions. So we have a high level of confidence in both the clinical and the financial components to long-term care. But all that being said, as Laval had stated earlier, if people dispute the outcome for eligibility, they can appeal. And any adverse action when it comes to eligibility can go through the appeals process. And that's where the Health Law Project can help people navigate what they need to do to go through an appeal.
So the orientation that Kevin was describing is about front door eligibility for Medicaid, getting into long-term care. The Community Health Choices Program, and that nothing's really changed about that system with Community Health Choices.
Correct.
The big difference is once you're in the system, we've got a managed care plan that's going ahead and is charged with, as Kevin was noting, having a network of long-term care providers, which include nursing homes, which include personal assistance agencies. And that managed care program, for the first time, is responsible for that long-term care, which we haven't had in Pennsylvania before. That's a really big challenge. That's a big difference. And they are charged with making sure all the services are coordinated.
Well, that brings up a point, and we only have a minute left, so we'll have to make this kind of quick. But we've been focusing a lot on the managed care part of it, the long-term care, but the managed care part of it. I mean, getting someone to the eye doctor if they need glasses, behavioral health, all those things, is that included in it?
So behavioral health is not part of Community Health Choices, but people are eligible for behavioral health managed care through the county system. We have a requirement that those services have to be coordinated between Community Health Choices and behavioral health. Since we have such little time, can I make a plug?
Okay. Go right ahead.
So if anybody received mailings or some information about Community Health Choices and you have questions, we encourage you to call the independent enrollment broker at 1-844-824-2000. 3655 or go to the enrollchc.com website to have questions answered about the networks.
And the website is a very good one. It does answer a lot of questions. I want to thank you both for being with us. Kevin Hancock with the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, Laval Miller-Wilson with the Pennsylvania Health Law Project. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Today's program, part of WIQF's Transforming Health. For more on this issue, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WIQF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.